Hello, and welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guest today is Stacy Rasgon, Managing Director and Senior Analyst, U.S. Semiconductors at Bernstein Research. Good morning, Stacy.
Good morning.
We're going to talk about Intel, but first, Stacy, tell me how you went from a PhD in chemical engineering from MIT to an outspoken analyst for the semiconductor industry. That's got to be a good story.
Yeah, you know, I'll give you my history in semis, and actually even started before grad school. When I was back in my undergrad years, you know, ages and ages ago, I did some undergraduate research for a professor, and I went to UCLA, and he did his work in semiconductors, and I was actually working on atmospheric pressure plasma processing, of all things. And it got me really interested in semis. And so when I had the opportunity to go to grad school, I wound up working in a lab. Actually, I did semiconductor manufacturing. I built plasma etchers while I was there. I actually have a PhD in how plasma etch transfers line edge roughness down feature sidewalls. I did some work at IBM TJ Watson while I was there. And, you know, frankly, in another like alternate timeline someplace, I'm probably working at Applied Materials or LAM or something like that. I mean, it was sort of been an interesting kind of run. Coming out of grad school, however, instead of going into industry, I went to McKinsey instead. But I worked 100% of my time virtually with McKinsey for semiconductor companies. And I served companies there all across the value chain and all over the world. Foundry, memory, capital equipment, automated test equipment, IDMs, like you name it, I did it. And I worked in the US and in Europe and in Taiwan pretty extensively. And so when it came time to leave McKinsey, as people do, the business model there is built on people leaving. It was a fantastic job. I know McKinsey gets a bad rap, especially today, you know, but I enjoyed my time there, and I enjoyed the people and projects I worked with within this industry. It was fantastic till my first kid was born. And then the consultant life is tough on family life. So I knew I wanted to leave, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I got a call from a recruiter. I mean, this sort of fell out of the sky and frankly for the Wall Street gig. And my first reaction was like, I don't want to do that. I've read those reports from all those Wall Street guys. They're totally worthless. Like, why would I want to do that? But I decided to give it a check and check it. And actually, the more I learned about it, the more interesting it kind of seemed. And it was an opportunity to kind of leverage both the academic as well as sort of the business background within semis. And so I came to Wall Street. And it was an interesting time, by the way, because I started this job in April of 2008, about 3 weeks after Bear Stearns failed. So it was sort of an interesting time to come to Wall Street. But it's been, you know, over a dozen years now I've been doing it, and it seems to be going pretty well so far. So we'll hopefully that can continue. But that's kind of how I got from there to here. It's definitely been a bit of a random walk.
Yeah, well, you're definitely one of my favorite analysts because you do actually know what you're talking about. And I agree with you on some of those reports, really hit and miss. And the disinformation in this industry is overwhelming sometimes. It's a complex issue, right? Semiconductors are hard, but it's nice to see some qualified people talking about it. So let's talk about Intel. You've covered Intel for many years. I grew up with Intel here in Silicon Valley. It's one of my favorite companies. I mean, they're just a huge leader in our industry, innovator, et cetera. Okay. But, you know, the question everybody asked me today and what I asked myself is, what the heck is going on over there?
Yeah. I mean, it's been a fall from grace for sure, right? And you know, look, so obviously, like, the public problems lately have come down to their process technology roadmap. And look, I mean, the issue is, I mean, they invented Moore's Law, and the communication for the last several decades was everything they're doing, the entire advantage is all about process technology. And by the way, that may or may not be true. Like process is absolutely important, but many other things are also important, right? But the messaging, like, for many years was like, we have this massive moat on process technology and it's unassailable. And when that turned out not to be true, like that causes problems. And I know it's getting a lot of attention now, but it's not like it's new. They've been actually having process issues for almost 10 years, right? I mean, their first issues happened during the 14 nanometer transition, you know, like it's almost 10 years ago. And 14, the yield ramp was delayed. And that's actually where they talked about moving from a 2-year transition to a 3-year transition at 14. The 14 issues didn't hurt them though, because they had a legitimate 5+ year leadership position at that point, so they burned a little bit of it. It was fine, but I mean, just given the hefty delays on 10, I mean, they burned that entire leadership budget. And now at this point, they're behind. And frankly, I mean, obviously the 7 nanometer problems that they announced last July caused a whole lot of angst. They claim they're fixed now. Like, well, we'll see. But I mean, they're at a point now where, you know, the process leadership is gone. And like, you know how this works. You've been in the industry a long time. Like, once you fall off the treadmill, it's like really hard to get back. And they're not going to regain the quote unquote leadership position unless TSMC screws something up. I mean, that's just how it is. If TSMC can keep executing, and by all accounts, like, they're not showing any signs of screwing up at this point. But I mean, unless they fall off the treadmill themselves, I think the best that Intel can hope for is to halt the, you know, to stop the gap from getting worse.
Yeah, you know, this actually started at 22 nanometer, right? It's when Intel came out with FinFETs, and they surprised the world, right? I had no idea they were coming.
But and, I mean, 22 actually, according to them at least, was like one of the fastest yielding processes in their history.
Well, right, so they say that, but we
know more. But that's the public story. So,
well, they say that, but we really don't know because they never talked about it. So it could have been late, it could have been early. We don't even know. Yeah. But after the 22, then they started being more public. And 14, I was there. I mean, I was there when BK, the new CEO, said he got up in front of us all and said 14 is fine, everything's good. And I had already talked to people I know, and I knew it wasn't good. And I stood up and said, no, it's not. <You know? laughs> And you know, they walked me out. So
they never actually walked me out of a meeting, at least. So like, that's good, I guess.
Yeah, but sometimes they ignore you, I noticed.
The problem I have, by the way, is I have a pretty low BS threshold.
Yeah,
and I
too.
Forget who I'm talking to once I get going. So it's just kind of hard. It's just something people around me have learned to live with.
Yeah, but you know, with BK, you know, he came from manufacturing, right? I mean, he should have known better, and it just really led me to believe that he was being fed false information, and you know, that's a leadership thing, of course. And but so what do you know about the new CEO? I mean, I don't know Pat personally, but boy, I tell you, I know people who know him. Of course, he's very well known, and I have not heard a bad thing about him.
No, he's got a very strong reputation, and he actually was at Intel when I started like officially covering the company in 09, although he left shortly after that. So I don't have a lot of experience with him at Intel because he was gone for, you know, 10 years or whatever it was, right? But his reputation obviously is very, very strong. And look, I'm going to, you know, like Pat is a great hire. Frankly, Pat's the guy they should have hired a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not knocking Bob. Like Bob, I think you know, he's done a, like, for whatever it is, I mean, to the best of his ability, he's done a good job, I think, to the extent that he could. But I mean, like, by his own admission, he's not really technical. I mean, like, in his legacy, like, for better or for worse, is kind of going to be a seat warmer for Pat, right? Yeah. And again, like I said, I'm not knocking Bob. I think Bob has done, like, for the situation that he was thrown into, he's done a good job. But, you know, Pat's the guy that they probably should have hired. And from what we heard is obviously they were trying to hire him 2 years ago. I still don't know why they weren't able to get him. I don't know what the issue was. But he's there now. So I think Pat can do a number of things on the positive side. So on the one hand, I think Pat should be much better equipped to correctly judge the risks and the opportunities from whatever options they have in front of them at this point. Whereas Bob, like I said, by his own admission, he's not really that technical. So he has less of a basis to, you know, parse and judge the information that he's getting from his bench, right? And if there are conflicting things, he's just, I mean, again, not knocking him, but he'll be less equipped to make those calls. Pat should be able to make the call one way or the other, right? The other thing that Pat can do is on the HR side, and frankly, of that third point letter that came out, like, one of the things I do agree with it is on the HR issues. They obviously had some problems. So Pat can ideally hope to attract some talent back, and he's already doing that. And then maybe he can help to keep talent. I mean, if I was an engineer there, you know, maybe I would have been thinking about leaving. And if Pat's coming in, maybe I'm more inclined to stick around. Like,
for
so
sure.
Those are all good things he can do. Now, on the downside, there's not a whole lot he can do, like, to change things for the next, like, call it like 2 to 3 years. That product roadmap for the next several years is likely baked. So whatever he's doing now is good. We'll see how it works out several years down the road. And like, we'll see. But there's not a whole lot he can do in the near term to sort of stop the train. Like it's a big ship. It takes a long time to steer it. And you know how it is in this industry, like you're continually investing today for things that are going to happen, you know, years down the line. So everything is going to happen in the next several years. Those decisions were already made years ago.
Yeah, you know, he's probably, you know, working on 3 nanometer. Hopefully that's still within his realm of influence. But 7 nanometer, obviously that ship has already sailed. You know,
Bob, they're claiming 7 nanometers is fixed now. So like, we'll see.
You know, based on the papers that they presented at IEDM and ISCC, they have a lot more fixing to do because, you know, 10 nanometer was designed for EUV. It didn't get there. Their metal layers are a mess. So hopefully they have EUV for 7 nanometer. Hopefully they have enough EUV machines to get a production. But, you know, the thing I really liked about Bob Swan is, you know, financial guy, right? And I really think that Intel should be outsourcing more of their business, and especially now that AMD is on TSMC's processes. And so, you know, the idea of having Intel and AMD on the same process really excites me, because that'll take, you know, a big part of an equation about who's got the better designs. You know, you take the process away, it's a level playing field, and you know, who's going to win? I'm really excited by that, and I'm pretty confident that Intel will be doing, you know, Intel chips on TSMC 3 nanometer, you know, in a year or so. And you know, how do you think that's going to turn out?
Yeah, see, we've heard a lot of conflicting stuff. So there's been a lot of news flow on, yeah, they'll do 3 nanometers in 22 or whenever it is. And then they also came out on the call, though, and said, well, we're going to be doing the bulk of our 7 nanometer products in-house in 2023, right?
Right, but you even said the majority, it means 51%,
Well,
right?
he said the majority, yeah. So there's some wiggle room there because, yeah, technically the majority
Serious
would be
wiggle room.
1%. So we'll see. And then also he said the 7 nanometer. So I mean, maybe they are 7 nanometer, but that doesn't say necessarily anything about what they might be doing on 5 or 3 or whatever elsewhere,
Yeah.
right? You know, so there's a lot of like wiggle room in those spaces, in the spaces of those statements. And so we'll see. I'll be honest, like if I'm Intel, there's positives and negatives from the outsourcing. Obviously, if you're outsourcing, you know, you save CapEx, and although I mean you're paying a foundry margin, but I mean TSMC is likely a more efficient manufacturer than Intel is anyway, so maybe that helps.
Well, you know,
And obviously,
the wafer, you know, Stacy, the wafer costs are about 20% less for TSMC.
I'm sure
So.
we just did a piece not that long ago. I mean, we were looking, and I mean, it was we thought like in terms of just like wafer output per dollar of CapEx, it could have been a 30% plus savings at TSMC versus what Intel delivers. And I believe that. I think it's
Yeah,
true.
it's
Right.
closer to 20, but still, that's not a huge amount, right?
Ballpark, right? I mean, like it's still, right? But I mean, that helps, that offsets some of it. But I mean, that's a positive. Maybe you save some process or R&D, you save some cost. And frankly, I mean, you get more certainty on the roadmap. If your own roadmap is uncertain, and frankly, it's still uncertain at Intel. Let's be honest, right? You get more certainty. The downside of outsourcing a material amount of your volume is you're putting your destiny in TSMC's hands.
Right.
So I don't know how eager that is. And then frankly, if Intel and AMD are both on the exact same process, let's just make a, like I've got a magic genie, they snap their fingers and tomorrow Intel's 100% out, so it won't be. But let's just imagine they're both making everything on TSMC. You're right, so then you got to fight on an architectural basis. Like, I don't know exactly how they are, we'll see. But let's say they're equivalent on architecture and they're equivalent on process. I don't know, is that a path to it? And they're at the same manufacturer who's allocating the capacity. Is that a path to a 50-50 market share? Like maybe.
Yeah.
That's not a good thing for Intel, right? If it goes to 50-50, it's great, be great for AMD,
Yeah.
obviously, but it's not so good for them. So I don't know how eager they are to outsource like everything, unless they can't actually fix it in-house, then you got no choice, right? So
Well, you
we'll
know,
see.
the other thing, and this is something that I've spoken to Intel about before, is, you know, it also holds the Intel manufacturing feet to the fire,
Yes.
because if you have an option, and this is why I thought Bob Swan, it was a great deal, because I don't think he had a lot of control over manufacturing. He didn't have a lot of relationships there,
Wow.
so you know, he could have played one against the other. But you know, one of the first things Pat did, which I really am impressed by, is he brought back his trusted few, right? So he brought back his old friends, his lifeboat, as some people call them. And so he's going to be able to have trusted people in the key areas of the company, so he can get the proper information, which I don't think the last two CEOs had, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and that was to my point, exactly that Pat should be better equipped to sort of judge what's going on, right? Whereas like Bob and even, but it's surprising that BK couldn't. Like that's a whole other like topic for discussion at some point. Like what the hell was going on with BK? Like I still don't know, but it was kind of shocking the whole thing. Anyways, but yes, I agree. So we'll see. And like I said, anything they're doing, you know, 2023 probably is when you'll start to see it really impact. Like the product roadmap the next couple of years is pretty much baked. And this is where it gets really interesting because like the shift to the stock standpoint, like there's been this hope trade going on with Intel. It's actually like ever since they hired Pat, you know, Intel's been up and AMD's been down, and sort of the hope that was, you know, the hope trade that was being applied to AMD is now being applied to Intel. We're going to hear at some point in the relatively near future more details on the plan. You know, the demand environment right now is pretty good, right? PCs and everything are like super, like, we'll see how long that lasts, by the way. But yeah, you know, and there's this hope trade going and you know, people are buying the stock on that. And so, but it's interesting because you have this sort of near-term kind of tactical, you know, kind of like a hope move on the stock, like contrasted with the next like few years where I know they're going to continue losing share to AMD. It's a matter of like trajectory and degree, not if, right? I know the entire Apple volume is moving away, and Apple's about, you know, 8 or 9% share in notebooks and maybe 3 or 4% share in desktops. That's right. All moving away. And that presumes that Apple doesn't actually take any share. Their parts actually, their products look pretty good, right? Right. I've got like on the data center side, like ARM is now, again, it's just like it's slowly and then all at once, right? The ARM push in the data center has been taking forever, but it's finally starting to maybe inflect a little bit. And Amazon's deploying Graviton, and you got, my guess is over the next 12 to 24 months, you'll hear announcements or news flow from every hyperscale player doing their own ARM chips. God forbid NVIDIA actually manages to close the ARM deal, by the way.
Hey, so, I mean, just heard.
Few years, I think strategically challenging. And then, by the way, PCs, if it wasn't for COVID, like Intel's, like, I hate to say it, but Intel stock would be a lot lower. Like, right. PCs are incredibly strong right now. I don't know how long that lasts. I've got 4 kids. They've been home from school since April. I bought 4 notebooks last year.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what saved Intel's year, yeah. Really.
So what does it look like next year? Like for now, they're very, very strong. I just don't know how long it lasts. And I could even argue that maybe the run rate going forward should be higher than it was in the past. Maybe like remote is more of a thing. But I mean, we had 300 million PCs in 2020. We haven't seen numbers like that in years and years. PCs were up mid-teens. Notebooks were up 35%.
Right.
I mean, the run rate of PCs peak pre-COVID was like 250 million units. We hit 300 last year. It could be up 10% again this year, right? It's not implausible, right? I mean, yeah. So like that starts to get potentially challenging. So like we'll see. So the next few years are going to get interesting, and you're sort of playing off this kind of like tactical near-term hope trade against the next. And the question will be how willing will people be to look through it, right? That's sort of the debate right now on the stock, right?
Yeah. So you know, what about the other interesting outside factor is, you know, the U.S. government and all, yes, these supply chain issues. And, you know, the question is, can Intel be a foundry? I mean, I was covering Intel when they came out and said we're going to be a foundry. And, you know, they said the fabless model is dead. You know, you have to go to an IDM. You know, yeah, that ended poorly. But, you know, there's rumblings again. Hey, you know, Intel, yeah, it can be a U.S.-based foundry for the, yeah, U.S. government and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, has that really hit the front of your mind yet?
Well, yes and no. So, I mean, the idea that, look, so one of the few areas of bipartisan agreement in the government right now is for semiconductor manufacturing. And okay, I mean, the numbers they're tossing right now, by the way, are a rounding error. Let's be honest. What was Biden saying, $37 billion?
Yeah, that's nothing.
I mean, my own opinion, by the way, if we really want to like massively build this up in the US, it's got to be like an Apollo moment. We need 10x that number, more. And we need big efforts around customer acquisition, because if you build all these factories, what are you going to fill them with? And how are you going to staff them? We need education reform and immigration reform and like all this stuff. So you need this like holistic movement that I'm not sure the appetite is yet, but it's a start, right? Yeah. Now, if we're going to like give Intel money, they might get money from the government. It's sort of interesting because it'd probably be a you know, good thing, although I think that's part of the bull case right now. But like Intel's problem is not having enough money. They have plenty of money.
Right.
Now, just giving them more money doesn't help. You'd have to be subsidizing them to do so. And again, your point on foundry is interesting. Because if we really want to attract lots of manufacturing back to the U.S., I mean, Intel, they're a leading edge manufacturer, but they really only make stuff for themselves. So if you're trying to build up like a large scale like manufacturing base in the U.S., it's got to be for third parties. You're going to have to give the money to TSMC and Samsung. They're the only ones with like leading edge foundry businesses that have customers. So then you ask the relevant question is okay, well, could like the U.S. anoint Intel as a national champion, and could they be a foundry? Maybe it could happen, right? To your point, they've tried it before. It didn't work out all that well because the foundry is a completely different business model and it's treated differently, right? How do you prioritize your customers? Obviously, Intel had everything that was sort of like aligned for themselves. Now, one thing they have been saying that I think Bob even mentioned on the last call, that they're going to be using more like industry standard tools and things like that. So maybe that might make it a little more easier over time. But I mean, it'll take a long time because they're going to have to convince customers to come over, right? And again, they don't have a real good track record. And the economics of the foundry industry are different. And right. So I did a note on this back in 2012, which was like the last time, you know, a lot of this talk was going on. It was right before they bought Altera, right? And the idea back then, it was people were saying, oh, they're going to do a foundry and build stuff for Apple. Like that was the story back, like it was almost 10 years ago. And we went through the math. And look, I mean, on the surface, if you were able to build, like, let's say, like a large, like greenfield, like foundry business for a big customer, like, and then, by the way, I haven't done the math recently, so this was like almost 10 years old, but this is how it looked then. You know, the economics weren't necessarily awful. I mean, it's lower gross margin than their current business because they get both a manufacturing and a design margin right now. And if you're doing manufacturing, you just get the manufacturing margin. So lower gross margin. I wasn't necessarily convinced that it was lower operating margin because you figure the OpEx burden could be lower, right? You could share some costs across and it's, again, it's a different kind of model. You know, so the economics could have been reasonable. Again, gross margin, dilutive, operating margin's okay. It was a lower return on capital, especially if you had to build it out greenfield, because you'd be getting less gross profit dollars per wafer for every dollar of capex than they get in their core business. So that doesn't necessarily mean it was a bad thing to do, as long as they're getting a return on it that's higher than their cost of capital, you could do it. But it'd be a lower spread, a lower return on their cost of capital probably than they were getting in their core business at the time. So you'd have to believe that they have no other better opportunities to do. But I mean, if they're going to get money from the government to fund it, maybe that changes that equation a little bit. The other thing that could help is that over time, maybe, you know how Intel works, right? They've got leading, they rotate their capacity over. Maybe it gives them something else they could like use like their capacity longer. Like that's kind of what TSMC does, right? They put in stuff and today's leading edge is tomorrow's mature node. That's right, another right. Like complication that maybe the economics could look good. But in general, I don't think the economics will look as good as what their current business does. I mean, just naturally. Yeah. And it's very high capital intensity, obviously. So we'll have to see the magnitude of the investment. I think without like outside funds, I don't think they do it.
Yeah, you know, it's a huge ecosystem, the foundry business. And, you know, this is why TSMC is successful, more successful than some of the other foundries, is they have this huge ecosystem that follows them around. And, you know, there's billions of dollars of R&D going into, you know, TSMC's ecosystem. So TSMC's contribution is by far smaller than every, you know, the total sum. But yeah, you know, I've been in the foundry business since they came out, and I've been telling Intel not to do it for years. But you know, I mean, stick what you're good at, and TSMC is good at it. And you know what? The other thing TSMC did, which is something Intel really has to take note of, is instead of doing these big giant node steps, TSMC is doing the half node shuffle, right? Yeah. They're doing a node every year, and it's based on Apple, right? They started doing this at 20 nanometer with the iPhone, and you know, it as it turns out, and people, you know, downplayed it, say, oh, you guys aren't doing real nodes. Yeah, but guess what? They were experiencing yield learning. I mean, that's the only reason why they're moving so fast they are today, because they're doing half nodes, right?
You know, Intel used to laugh at them, like, oh, their node isn't the same as ours. They put up these charts showing how their Intel's better than Intel's 10 is better than TSMC 7, and they were ignoring the time factor. So they were ignoring that the TSMC process was available and the Intel process was vaporware.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so like that's again. The other thing is, I don't get too worked up about like oh, this, it's not really seven or anything. The numbers themselves, as you know, are complete and total marketing. They don't mean anything. Right? You can call like whatever you want 7 nanometers. Like doesn't matter. I mean, and I always say like customers, in some sense, I mean they care, but they really don't. They don't buy little envelopes full of transistors, right? They buy chips that do what they want them to do in a price, power, and performance envelope that's suitable and that are available when they need them.
So let's get back to Intel. You know, in Pat's first 100 days, I mean, he's made some key moves. He's made some hiring, but we really don't know what he's going to do. I mean, I think one of the next key milestones is when they come out with their CapEx.
Yeah, and is it flat up or down for the year? Right, I mean, for sure.
Yeah, and you know, it's my hope that they get flat, that CapEx is flat or a little bit down, but R&D is up, right? Because they really need to get. I mean, 7 nanometer, again, that ship has sailed, but they really need to get their 5 nanometer or whatever they call it, and then they have to do the transition to the next technology, you know, device technology. So, you know, FinFETs are almost done. You know, they're going to have to get the gate all around, and you know, the word on the street is that Samsung gate all around is not doing well. So there's a lot of work to be done, and you know, if they don't bump up their R&D, I'm going to be concerned. And if they just bump up their CapEx, I'm going to be really concerned because TSMC's CapEx is record high. Samsung's CapEx is record high. I mean, we don't have enough demand for yet another record high CapEx from another semiconductor company.
Do we not? I don't know. I mean, demand in general is off the charts right now. It's like, I don't know. Everybody's on allocation and there's shortages. And so we'll see.
Well, you know, shortages go towards utilization. You know, that's different from capacity, right?
Yeah, I know. I mean,
Everybody pushed their orders out and capacity is still there. It's just utilization went down and, you know, we're turning it back on, but it's not a switch you can flip, right? It's
going to take another thing you got to remember with CapEx, by the way, it's just, it's more, every incremental wafer is more expensive now, right? I mean, I mean, kind of a rule of thumb I tend to sort of keep in the back of my mind. I sort of feel like the cost of a leading edge wafer is like doubling every 5 years.
That could be.
It's kind of in that, plus or minus whatever, right? But I mean, it's not a bad sort of like zeroth order approximation. It's going up a lot, and so you're getting less, you know, less capacity for every dollar of CapEx, especially the leading edge.
Yeah.
Right. It's expensive, and then like let's wait till they start going to like high NA EUV tools or something. I mean, like, oh my God.
So, final thoughts on Intel. Do you have any?
Yeah. Just in general.
Yeah, based on what we talked about.
So, like I said, I can see the hope trade that, like, I've always sort of said, like, the bull case on it is cheap hope. It's like it's inexpensive. Even on my numbers, that if I look at it, I'm quite a bit below. But even on my numbers, it's inexpensive, and maybe something will go right. That's kind of the bull case. Pat brings hope, and so we'll see what they say. And I think people are buying it on, you know, we're going to get color on the plan, like whether it's on their earnings or whether they do something before. I don't know yet, but we'll get color ideally on things like, you know, the CapEx guide and kind of the incremental investments. Well, they didn't guide the full year. Maybe they'll guide the full year, and like maybe numbers are good. So there's that hope trade that's going on. I do think the next two to three years are going to be very challenging, though, like strategic. I think Pat's got his work cut out for him. And the question is going to be, like, how willing are people, like, going to be to hold it through that? So we'll have to see what kind of story they tell, you know. But, I mean, look, it's to their credit, I mean, Pat's very good. And just in general, I mean, the company, it's a behemoth, right? That's the other part of the bull case is, like, they spend – I know you want them to take R&D up, but, I mean, they spend $13 billion in R&D. Like, what the hell are they doing with all of it? Like, there's got to be something in there, right, that's good. That they can drive value out of, because otherwise, why are they spending all this money?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I just hope they stick to their core competencies. You know, yeah. I really want them to get their manufacturing house in order. And you know, I'm not a big fan of all the distractions that they have. And I think a foundry business would just be an unwanted distraction. And, you know, the thought of them going fabless is ridiculous. Just a lot of people are talking about it, but I don't think
like I said, unless they had no choice, I don't think they want to put that much of their destiny in somebody else's hands. Okay. Again, you look at AMD, right? AMD had a very good year last year. They probably would have had a better year if they could have gotten more capacity from TSM. They sold everything they could make.
Yeah.
Right. This year, they've given a pretty strong growth forecast, and their capacity at TSMC is going to go up this year. Right. But I mean, does Intel want to be limited by how much capacity they have? And like, I don't know. Right. I mean, obviously, you don't want to put your destiny in someone else's hands if you can avoid it.
Well, you know, TSMC has wafer agreements. People sign wafer agreements, and that's what they build capacity for. Right now, everybody's exceeding their wafer agreements because nobody imagined what would happen, right, with the pandemic. But that's good news for TSMC, by the way, because when you exceed your wafer agreement, you tend to pay more for wafers.
Sure, so, I mean, yeah.
so all upside for TSMC.
Yeah, look, you know, I always say, like, TSMC is potentially one of the most strategically important companies in the world, maybe them and ASML, right?
I think TSMC wins. Yeah,
this is why there's all the concern from the U.S. government, because I mean it's 100 miles offshore from China, and China thinks they own the ground that it's sitting on, and that's becoming like an increasingly untenable situation. So that's why there's the big push to bring manufacturing back to the U.S.
Yeah. That's another topic. Yeah. Okay, well, that ends our podcast today. Thank you, Stacy. And
oh, you bet. My pleasure.
We'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure.
All right. Look forward to it anytime.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.